Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600. And thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks. Dr. Christie joins me now from Engelberg Christie Animal Hospital in Fairfield. Dr. Christie, thanks for being here. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you. So, Dr. Christie, yesterday we had a Facebook question of the day asking people if they're hearing about illegal fireworks. I have to tell you, the overwhelming response was not only are they hearing them, but they are very upset because their dogs are hating the fireworks. Their cats are scared of the fireworks. Is this the time of year that you start to see pets coming in because their anxiety is through the roof?
I don't know if they're coming in, but I'm sure getting a lot of phone calls for pets with anxiety. And it seems like there's more fireworks this year than I recall. Anyway, it seems to be starting earlier and going later. Yeah, lots of bing, bang, boom.
So this may seem like a very naive question, but why is it a bad combination? Why do fireworks and pets, they really just don't go together?
Well, it scares the animals. They don't understand the sounds. I mean, some animals are thunderphobic, that the loud noises shake the house. Fireworks are just like that. Even hunting dogs who are used to gunfire as a puppy have to become acclimated. They don't automatically tolerate big loud noises. They're scary. Mm-hmm. So for animals who aren't in the hunting family, these are scary experiences. And depending on the animal, they get real nervous. They can start to cry, whine. I've had them go break out through screen doors, chew up the house. Anxiety is no fun for anybody, and it makes the owners also very unhappy.
Mm-hmm. And I know, unfortunately, every year we start to hear about those news stories where dogs go missing, cats go missing because people go to fireworks displays. Unfortunately, we're in a situation where people aren't going anywhere. They're at home, and this is just happening in the backyards or in the neighborhoods nearby. What would you say to people who maybe aren't thinking about, you know, the fact that a lot of residents in Connecticut have pets, and overall pets are not big fans of the loud noises and sort of the spectacle of fireworks?
Oh, absolutely. Well, it would be nice to your neighbors not to set off fireworks, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
For the babies, pets, and everybody's concerned. Let the government do the fireworks. Let the shows go on.
Mm-hmm.
And if you own pets, you want to protect your pets. You want to keep them inside so they're not outside, so they don't get terrified and want to escape. If you've got a quiet place in the house, maybe an inside interior room or down a finished basement or something like that, a little background noise, TV, radio, something to kind of mask it. If the animals are crate trained, sometimes the crate's a place of security for them, or on their dog bed with their favorite treat. Sometimes that is enough. If that's not, there are some homeopathic remedies, anti-anxiety kind of things that people can try. Those are generally safe, and they're pretty mild. And for animals who are even more affected, we actually have prescription medications that we sometimes use for anti-anxiety meds. And so there's a variety of things. It depends on how upset the animal gets. And I will also tell you that noise phobias, whether it's thunder or fireworks, tend to get worse over time. So if we can nip it in the bud when they first start getting nervous, and if we can calm them and bring them to a safe place, we can avoid in the future having worse reactions.
So this is something that you should be, especially if you have a younger dog, looking at really addressing this problem now, because it would, I would think, escalate as they get older.
Oh, absolutely. Right. As part of puppy visits, we talk about socialization and avoiding this kind of thing. So, yes, I'd rather nip it in the bud, rather catch it early and have it not become a big problem. Yes.
And do you ever, and it sounds like you, if you need to, you would recommend possibly, if your vet says it's okay, to be able to medicate your animal as well?
Oh, of course. We'd want to start simple. We'd like to limit medication as much as we can. So we start with the behavioral stuff. Now we usually try the mild over-the-counter kind of preparations. And sometimes if that's not enough, we need to go to prescription meds. That's right.
And I know you were saying that sometimes there will be animals that will cry or will visibly shake. What if your animal is already on the calmer side? What if they just don't really display what would seem to the naked eye, oh, my dog is clearly nervous right now? Like, I look at my dog, Trusty, who is sometimes he will be visibly nervous about things. But, you know, with the fireworks, I notice he doesn't react. But like he reacts with thunder and things like that. So are there signs of, you know, hey, maybe he's not showing it, but he's still nervous, if that makes sense?
No, dogs actually wear their heart on their sleeve.
Okay.
If trustees relax around fireworks, then he can discriminate thunder from fireworks. And if it's only thunder, good for him. So the dogs who are relaxed and whatever, let him be relaxed. I don't think there's anything you need to do.
Okay.
And in fact, animals are very sensitive to human emotions around them. Animals who are in a house where people are upset for whatever reason often become nervous themselves. It's kind of emotions contagious.
Mm.
And so if the owner's calm, if the dog's calm and the owner's also relaxed about it, that's a great situation.
Okay. That's actually
interesting. We don't want to feed our animals' anxiety.
Okay. No, that's really interesting because I know there were a number of people who said that they were just upset they can't sleep at night. So if they're feeling anxious and nervous and upset or anything like that, then it could translate to the dog.
Oh, absolutely. They're very sensitive to our emotions.
How about cats?
Yes. Cats are a different subject.
Cats are a whole other subject.
Yes, they are. Honestly, I don't know of any cats who are thunder or fireworks phobic. Now I'm sure I'll get a phone call today about somebody who's cat, but it is not something that I generally see. It's not something in veterinary circles that we really talk about as a topic.
Huh.
Pretty much it's dogs.
All right.
Also horses and some other animals, but cats don't seem to be bothered by loud noises.
That's so interesting. How funny that is. Well, Dr. Christie, yeah. I appreciate your insight this morning. If anybody wants to give you a call or they want to book an appointment for their pets, where can they go?
Sure. My office number is 203-367-4475.
All right. Easy enough. Thank you so much, Dr. Christie. I'll talk to you really soon.
All right. Thanks, Melissa. Bye-bye.
Chatting this morning with Shauna Melton, who is an award-winning poet, painter, art consultant, and she's from right here in Bridgeport. And Shauna, thank you so much for being here this morning. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Now, Shauna, you and I, we spoke off the mic and you were telling me about your family history. You grew up basically surrounded by musicians, artists. What does art mean to you so many years later?
I think it means the same thing as it did when I was young, and I'm thankful for that. I needed a way to express myself and say the things that I feel. I wanted to make the surroundings that I was in more beautiful, whether it's my room or an environment. And I felt like I can control that with art by bringing in bright colors and good energy. And so that was what I wanted to do, you know. It was a way to tap out of problems and a way to tap into my thoughts and meditation. And it has always been a useful tool that way for me. So I still feel that way. I feel like when society is going wrong, when relationships go bad, when life gets hard, I can tap into art. I can also do it to bring other people good energy and joy and love. And, you know, it's a way that I still do process things. When you have problems and you don't want to focus on the world, you can focus on creating something. Mm-hmm. And so that has been a very useful tool for wellness personally and for the people around me.
Have there been moments in your career where art or writing have been a safe haven for you to be able to express yourself or to work through issues that you were or the country was dealing with?
Definitely. Once you put something in the world, it's in the world, you know? So once you put something in a journal, you can figure out how you want to say it, where you want to take it, if you still agree with yourself. Because sometimes things sound better on the inside than they do on the outside, you know.
Yeah.
So it's a process. It helps you process, you know. And you don't, when you write on paper, you don't have to deal with judgment. You don't have to deal with, you know, other people's opinions or feelings. you know, even in my writers group, I tell people, write it out. And if you don't want to share it, you don't have to. You have control over this. This is your thoughts. And if you don't want to keep it, I'll take you to the park and we can just dissolve it in the water and say a prayer. But what we're not going to do is let ourselves be sick and hurt and keep it inside if we don't have to.
How are you engaging other people, especially younger minds right now, to be able to express themselves through art or through writing?
I think my writers group has really been powerful in that way. I have been able to encourage other writers. Like, I bring them into a space where it's love. You know, I don't want to take anyone's power from them. So I ask them if they want feedback. And I ask them if they want to share. Well, in the opposite order, I ask them if they want to share. And then I ask them if they want feedback. If they say no, it's no. If they say yes, then we give them constructive feedback. You know, and I think a lot of people feel empowered. One of the things I love about working with adults is that we go through life paying bills and taking care of kids and, you know, being responsible. But we don't always stay responsible for our passions. And so there's a lot of people who have let go of art and let go of writing and let go of the creative side to be responsible. But there's also a responsibility in self-expression and leaving a legacy of your creativity behind. And I think we lose sight of that. And so when people come into my group, they're tapping into something that they thought they would have to let go of a long time ago. And so I'm thankful to watch that, to watch the joy and even the tears and all the feelings that they're working through because they haven't been able to do this in so long. And like with kids, I'm currently working with LifeBridge, with their after school urban scholars program. And we were doing virtual classes during the time of Corona. And you know, kids are able to take the classes online and learn how to paint koi fish and, you know, do different art projects at home and keep their minds stimulated. And I've done my writer's group with young people, and it's really fun. And I especially love, like, 11 and 12-year-olds because they're still innocent, but they also have a great writing levels, and they're very interested and creative. And so, yeah, I love working with people. That's been one of the hardest things about right now. I'm so heavily centered around community, mm-hmm. but everybody's in their house.
Shauna, when is the retreat for your writers group?
It's the weekend of September 11th. It's going to be at the Wisdom House in Litchfield, Connecticut. We did one last year, and we're doing this one. It's called Dragonfly Transformation. And, you know, the dragonfly is my spirit insect. I had a show at the Barnum Museum recently called Her Dragons Fly. And, you know, I just align them with transformation. That's Native American culture does the same. And sometimes it's believed to be about death and transformation, but it's also about evolving and changing. And I think we've all been through a lot of changes. And when I talked to my writers group about what they would like to do when we returned to the Wisdom House, they wanted to write about what we've been through, you know? And so it's about what restoration looks like. It's about your feelings at this time and documenting that and how we're going to implement those emotions and visions into a new future. And so dragonfly transformation, if you learn about the dragonfly, they fight for their life underwater. They eat each other to stay alive. But then when you see them above water, they're glorious and they go everywhere and they're able. They fought for their life. And I think they appreciate it more. When my grandmother got sick, I started seeing dragonflies everywhere. Wow. And even when she passed, and then a series of people in my life passed away. And I remember I was at my dear friend Antoinette's memorial, and a dragonfly leveled up with me right in my eyes. And somebody said, "Hey, Antoinette," and it just flew away, you know?
That's amazing.
And when I did my exhibit at the Barnum, a lot of people had those stories. When I explained what inspired the dragonfly concept, and I explained this, a lot of people had stories like that.
That is so cool. And if you want to learn anything more about Shauna Milton and read up on her collection, learn more about the work she's doing, connect with her personally, her website is Poetic Soul arts.net. And Shauna, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me this morning. I really appreciate it, and I hope you continue to connect with so many people. You're amazing.
Thank you. You are too, and thank you for your support.
We are headed to the moon this morning. David Mestre with the Discovery Museum joins me live now. David, how are you?
Oh, I'm doing well, Melissa. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thank you. So let's talk about water on the moon. First of all, that's sort of a phenomenon for some people who are not as well-versed in outer space as you are. Talk to us a little bit just about water on the moon, this evidence that it actually exists.
Yeah, so we were getting hints that there might actually have been water on the moon. But I guess we chalk this up for like one of those scientific results that stares us in the face, but we just can't believe it. Almost like 10 years ago, we were getting hints that special spaceships were actually detecting signs of what could have been water. And that was an Indian spaceship that actually orbited for about 10 months, and there were like signatures of water on the surface. And still, that was a bit of a stretch for people to believe, or at least the scientific community, because the conventional wisdom was that the moon is just bone dry.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, we actually sent a spacecraft to the south pole of the moon, and it was an upper stage of a rocket and a special spacecraft that was going to aim this upper stage right into a crater and then send the crater. This upper stage right into the crater, impact it, and a plume of material would come out, and we would measure to see what's in that plume. And sure enough, we found water, real evidence that there's actually water on the surface of the moon. And it's only later that we started going back to studies of moon rocks that were collected by astronauts in the 1960s and 70s that hints that there was water in those samples staring us in the face, that yes, there's actually water on the surface of the moon.
So how did we miss that?
You know, I think, like I said, it's sometimes, you know, among the scientific community, we get to a point where we think something is so true and so painfully obvious that even if there's a little hint of evidence that might contradict that, sometimes we don't see it until we have this overwhelming a body of evidence that basically kicks us into thinking something otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And so when that happened, it was a real shock and surprise, because people that were the scientific community that studied the moon, that was sort of the conventional wisdom that, you know, there's just no way there could be any water on the surface of the moon. And it's not the kind of water that you see here, bodies of water like lakes and rivers and ponds. We think it's under the surface, and it's not in really high concentrations. You would have to collect about a baseball field size amount of soil from the surface of the moon to get a glass of water.
Oh, wow. Okay. That puts things in perspective. Yeah. Okay. Well, then okay. Yep. That's helpful. I love when
that
you do
sense.
Things like that. Yes. When you break it down like that, it just makes sense to the guys out here like me, who I'm thinking to myself, it seems like it'd be pretty obvious, but that helps a lot. Now, my understanding is there is a private company out of Pittsburgh that's going to be sending a lander carrying NASA's Viper rover to search for water on the moon. That's happening right now?
Yeah, so it's we're looking at a launch in 2023.
Oh,
and
wow.
But what's really exciting is that the contract to send NASA's Viper rover was actually given to a private company. And so this is the first time under the Commercial Lunar Payload Services program that a private company is actually sending NASA hardware to the moon.
Oh, cool.
And this is in line with a lot of the commercialization of space, where SpaceX got a commercial contract to send NASA astronauts into space. We're creating these partnerships with private companies to send hardware to the moon and maybe even Mars and beyond.
Mm. Where are we at, actually, just on a side note, with sending people up to the moon? Do you remember a few years back? I don't even remember exactly when it was, but I know my husband and I had a conversation during our dating years where he said, would you go if we had, you know, endless amounts of money to send people up to the moon? Would you go? And I said, no, I'd be too scared. But is that still something that is being worked on, being able to send people if they're not astronauts, they just want to go to the moon? Is that still happening?
Yeah. So there was hints of a private company that was going to send a private astronaut on a trip to the moon, orbit around the moon, and come back.
Right. Yes.
You know, when you when you start to think of sending an astronaut to the surface, though, then the costs start to go up. A typical Apollo astronaut to the moon, that ticket to get to the moon, land on the surface, and come back, that was probably about $390 to $400 million for that ticket.
My God.
But
that's,
you know, that's you had all this hardware that you only got a chance to use once.
Sure.
The rocket once, the lander once, the spacecraft once, and that's a lot of hardware to throw away, and you have to rebuild that hardware to send the astronauts back. So that's why it was expensive. But I think what the future may look like is if you can reuse your hardware. Just like SpaceX is doing. They're reusing their rockets and going to reuse the spaceships. That drives the cost down. So just to send astronauts to the International Space Station, that ticket is about $55 million.
It's pocket change.
Yeah, yeah. And it's still a lot, but if that's because there's only one Crew Dragon.
Sure.
If you have enough of them and enough spacecraft and you reuse it, you start to, with this new economy, you start to drive those costs down. So will there be a time where, you know, you could actually hitch a ride to the moon? Not soon, because all that hardware is being developed by NASA, and that's still going to be pretty expensive.
Mm-hmm.
But going to space, you might see that maybe you can spend about $100,000, and that might get you a trip into space and back, maybe 10 million to a million to get into orbit. So those costs will start to get driven down as more and more players get into the commercialized sphere of space exploration.
Would you go?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah. In a heartbeat. Yeah,
yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Yeah. And I think part of it is, you know, like, it's something that's been embedded in me as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Kids that grew up during the shuttle era and the tail end of the Apollo era and seeing all these astronauts go into space. But what I think was really exciting is that you're seeing a new generation of kids that are really excited about space. And we did a FaceTime or a Facebook Live event on the Crew Dragon, and we had like about 100 people.
And Yeah,
and a bunch of them were kids that were watching this.
I love that.
And in fact, one of our kids, who's a Stratford resident, she saw the little dinosaur that was floating in the Crew Dragon spacecraft.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so she was able to score one. She found, I think, on Amazon or something, but she found that dragon and she bought it. So there's a picture of her with the dinosaur that was used to determine that the spacecraft had actually achieved orbit. And so she's got her little brontosaurus.
Oh, that is so cool! I love that. I love that.
So, we think sometime in the future maybe she'll be part of this new wave of astronauts that the cost was driven down to the point where now people can go.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Well, if you do ever end up going, David, I'm still going to make you call into the show and tell me how your experience is.
Yeah, it'll be a call collect.
Yeah, just call collect. Exactly. Maybe while we find water on the moon, maybe they've got phones up there too. Who knows?
We'll see
what we find. David, always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much. We'll talk to you again next week.
Next week.
All right. Looking forward to it. That's David Mestre. Lindsay, forgive me. I do not want to botch your name on the air. How do you say your last name?
Buendia.
I was going to go with that, too. Lindsay Buendia is here, and she is the co-creator of a nonprofit group called Summer Fun. Lindsay, thanks for being here this morning. How are you?
Good. Thank you very much for having me.
Absolutely. So first of all, I want to talk about what Summer Fun is. Where did that concept even come from? What is it?
Okay, so the concept of Summer Fun was created because around town and around our local communities, there was a lot of parents who were getting wine by wine fairies. And as much fun as that is, me and my girlfriend Jennifer, she's a really good friend of mine, we decided that the children really are the ones who need the pick-me-up during the summer. Mm-hmm. They missed out so much during the school year. Graduations, parties, friends, yearbook signings, dances, field trips, they missed everything. So we decided that let's give them a summer of fun. And so we started this group, and the group is for to give every child that we can a summer fun basket filled with summer toys, snacks, activities, things for them to do, because the future of school itself is just so unforeseen.
I love this concept. I think it's fantastic. Now, what age group are we talking about?
We're going all the way to seniors in high school.
Okay. So you're talking about like five-year-olds, like little kids all the way up to seniors in high school. That's pretty cool.
Absolutely. We're even doing some disabled children. So we're doing all age range.
And where exactly are you getting the items for this stuff? Because I have to imagine, like you said, it's not profit. So nobody, you know, it's not like someone's just handing you this stuff. You're getting mostly donations, correct?
Correct. So we have gotten some good donations from a local pizza place here in town who became kind of like our sponsor, which was nice. And a lot of the people in the community actually came together, and we have, like, my front room has got toys and coloring books and stuff right now ready for us to put baskets together. I know my friend Jennifer, same thing. She's gotten donations of, like, sunglasses and the plastic baseball bats for the boys and all kinds of goodies that we're just itching to put together in these baskets. But, yeah, it's definitely a community, a group effort, a village effort, if you want to say it that way, because it does take a village to raise a child.
Sure, absolutely.
So we're all together in this, and we're just trying to make this the best that we can for these kids.
Now, at the end of the segment, we're going to give people the resources they need to get involved if they want to donate or become a part of this. But how do you decide on which kids are getting this? How if you're a parent listening right now or a grandparent, you're thinking, wow, my child would really benefit from getting this. How do they go about getting involved?
So right now we have a group on Facebook, and it's called Summer Fun, and then there's a space and two exclamation points. On the front of the page is like a bunch of kids playing at the top border. They join our group, and they actually, we have all the towns listed here in Connecticut, and they pick their town, and they pick, you know, whatever, does the child have allergies, what kind of things are the child into, and they list their gender and their age, and our baskets are done according to that, because I wouldn't give like a pack of bubbles to a 20-year-old.
Right. Right.
So we have it that way. And right now we're looking at almost 50 kids right now.
Okay. Because I was going to say it may be way too hard for anybody to guess this. But how many baskets would you say you could fill at this point?
At this point, close to 100.
Wow. That's really cool. That's very cool. Now, are a lot of the kids you're getting inquiries from specific towns? Like, are they mostly Fairfield County? Are they from the northern part of the state? Where are you seeing, or is it kind of sporadic?
Fairfield County, New Haven County, Litchfield County, Middlesex County. Like, we're all the way up to West Hartford right now.
That is so cool. I love this. Now, are you looking to expand outside of Connecticut if this takes off?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's something that Jennifer and I had discussed, like, if this gets to the point where we can expand, did we want to? And the answer to that was yes, because it's, you know, we don't want to seclude any specific, okay, we're just to this county or we're just to this town. We, even if it went as far as California, we'd be willing to go that far.
That's really cool. I love this. I think it's such a cool concept. Again, we're talking to Lindsay, who's one of the two creators behind the nonprofit group Summer Fun. And if you're just tuning in, this is a pretty simple concept. It's two women. They are putting together baskets full of goodies, essentially, snacks, toys, sunglasses, crafts, things like that, to be able to give kids a little bit of a reprieve after everything they've gone through with the pandemic and missing school and their friends and different celebrations. Now, if you are somebody listening and they want to contribute to this, because again, you're not, it's this isn't a business, this is a nonprofit, so you're solely hoping for donations, basically. How can someone go about either giving you guys the money or donating items specifically?
So we actually have three options. We have a fundraiser right now through a company, and I could provide that link to you or to anybody who would like that. With the fundraiser, basically, they are able to purchase items for themselves, and the profit is solely going to us. We have a Cash App and a PayPal link to collect monetary donations, and we also have where if anybody decided, oh, I'm going to run to the store and pick up items, where do I bring them? It's either going to be dropped off to myself or to Jennifer.
Okay. Now, do you have a way for somebody to contact you directly so they know where you live? Because I know you're probably not going to want to throw your house address out on the radio, but is there a way that somebody can contact you if they want to drop something off?
I can leave my email if that works.
That'd be great.
Okay, so my email is Lindsay, L-I-N, D as in David, S-E-Y, M as Marie, B as in boy, U-E-N, D-I-A for Buendia at gmail.com.
All right, simple enough, and people can, I would think you want basically brand new toys, right? You don't want anything that's been used.
Correct. And the only thing that, like, me and Jennifer talked about was we're not expecting you to run to Target, Walmart, spend hundreds of dollars. You know, we're trying to keep it simple and fun. Whatever somebody can afford, we're not asking them to spend hundreds of dollars, like I said, even if it was $5, $10, you know, every little bit helps. One 3-pack of bubbles gives 3 children bubbles.
Yeah, that's so true. It's just that little community effort, and then it goes a long way. You know, one thing from one person, you know, if you have a whole group, that's 100 things, you know, from 100
right.
people. So that's very
exactly.
cool. I love that. Lindsay, thank you so much. I hope that your effort continues on, and hopefully it does expand even beyond Connecticut. So thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you, Melissa, for having us, and we appreciate it.
Absolutely.